A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, we collect data slowly, and I think it's wisely. Normally what you do is you trust people in small things, and as they deliver on those, you trust them on greater things, and people build up a trust level. I think it's foolish to just turn everything over to somebody that you don't know. In the beginning of the book, I talk about the three factors that you have to look at in order to trust somebody, and they are character, competence, and authority. And if people don't have all three of those, it's folly to trust them.
Welcome to Innovation and Leadership, where I interview uncommonly high achievers like top investment fund managers, elite special operations soldiers, startup CEOs who sold their companies for billions of dollars, pro athletes, Hollywood filmmakers, really as many different kinds of experts as I can. The whole idea is to hear how they did it and then what advice they have for the rest of us that can be applied to the organizations we're trying to grow and innovate. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's show. This is part two of our interview with Joel Peterson, chairman at JetBlue, author, Stanford professor, former CEO of real estate giant Trammell Crow, partner at Peterson Partners. I'm sure I'm missing a bunch of things here, Joel, but we've kind of been talking in the first episode about your book, The 10 Laws of Trust, available on Amazon. Everyone, please go to Amazon. If it's okay, I really want to talk about this number 9 on here, this forget you and become an effective leader. Can you give people a little bit of background on, you know, you've only got 10 on this list, why you chose that one?
Well, it's the notion of humility. And I think we don't trust people who never make a mistake, who are perfect, who are not vulnerable. Some people think that leaders cannot show vulnerability. They have to be all powerful, all knowing, et cetera. My experience with building high trust organizations is you have to get out of your own skin. It is not about you, and that means you're a learner. Humility just means that you're teachable, that you're willing to adjust what it was you believed by new facts, by new data. And the great high trust leaders are open, they're vulnerable, they're teachable, they admit mistakes, they change course, and they build trust along the way, and they get a lot of help along the way. And so in the short run, while it may make you appear powerful, to know everything, to have the answer, a quick answer for everything, to never change course, over the long run, and by the way, life and business and organizational development, building institutions is a marathon, not a sprint. And over the marathon, I think it's really the teachable, humble, learning leaders who build high trust and who enjoy the benefits.
You know, I'm thinking about how when you think about that concept and how much we all admire people who are like that, and yet we're so tempted for the short-term image management of not being like that, right? Again, this kind of maybe sounds like I'm asking the same question over and over, but I'd love to know who has set an example for you in your life when it comes to that, or who you look up to, aspire to for that.
So I guess a lot of people that I've seen in little snippets, you know, where they made a mistake and admit it immediately. Working for Trammell Crow, who I think is one of the great entrepreneurs of our era, was all about truth. It wasn't about him being right. And so I remember in a number of situations where he would make a case and he would ask for me to make the opposite case. And if I did a better job than he did of making the case, he would change his point of view. And he would embrace it. And what he was doing was he was solving for truth. Truth was the objective, not being right or looking good or looking smart, but solving for truth. And ultimately, truth has this really powerful way of winning over time. It's hard to get around it.
Yeah. And for people who aren't as familiar, can you give some context for folks of how large that organization has been at its peak?
Yeah, so Trammell Crow got to be about $14 billion in assets, maybe 3,500 people. It is today part of Coldwell Banker. So a lot of people have seen the CBRE sign.
Yeah.
It's a huge brokerage firm. It's actually a big real estate services company with about 70,000 employees all around the world. And Trammell Crow Company is its development arm. And today, I think they start something like $6 billion worth of new development every year. So it's still a very large, powerful company. It just happens to be within the parentage of CBRE.
Well, I'm glad you used this one as an example, because to me, it relates a little bit back to what you were speaking about earlier about when you get into really senior roles, especially at, you know, a very successful organization like that one, there can be such a temptation from folks below to manage up, you know, to maybe tell the boss what they want to hear because they're hoping for a promotion, or they think it will, you know, they think it may be an advantage to them, or because sometimes the ego of the individual at the top, you know, requires that. So it's interesting to hear somebody who, you know, with that kind of success could probably hire a bunch of yes men, you know, but for him to intentionally choose to seek that out, you know, when arguably he could probably get away with not doing it in some ways, right?
Yeah. Well, I think related to that was at Crow, we always tried to, the idea was to always hire people who are smarter than you, who are better than you. And, you know, it's really interesting. For me, that wasn't that hard, but for some people it was a little harder. But I actually think that it really makes you a much stronger organization. And for us, we organized as a partnership. So it wasn't hierarchical. And I'm actually on the board of a company called Franklin Covey, which is a corporation. It's a publicly traded corporation. But Bob Whitman, the CEO, talks about it, about the people there being partners. And we're all partners together. And this notion of being partners, I think, is a really powerful one. We have fiduciary duties to each other. We are our brother's keeper in a way. And I think that's a really powerful way to build high trust organizations when it's not hierarchical, when you're not looking to hire weaker people under you, when you celebrate everybody being as strong as they can be, as capable as they can possibly be.
So let's talk about him for just one second. You know, there's so many organizations that have a poster like that on the wall, but it sounds like he really lives it.
Well, if you don't, it will actually create cynicism. There's nothing worse than sort of celebrating, trumpeting some virtue that you don't live. All that happens then is there's cynicism that develops. And that's actually one of the problems with mission statements that are framed and put on the walls, is people say, well, how are people behaving compared with that? And if there's a gap, it gets back to that issue of structural integrity. If there's a say-do gap, people become cynical, and they become wary, they become cautious, they don't trust anymore. And in many cases, they start looking for a job somewhere else.
Yeah. So thinking specifically of him, is there any story or a little snippet or anything that you can think of besides talking about it as partners? Is there, you know, I can think of in a meeting when he chose to speak last, but he could have spoken first. Or is there any little tidbit of history that you think that comes to mind? I know I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, I'd probably have to think about it, but I think the idea of, you know, you've brought up this idea of speaking. He could have spoken first and always and forever at any meeting. He was the founder of the company. His name was on the door, but he was always more interested in putting other people first, pushing people forward. He gave young people, very young people, lots of responsibility, made them partners often within 18 months of joining him.
This so is Trammell Crow?
Yeah, he was always advancing others.
Yeah. And then what about at Franklin Covey, the CEO of Franklin Covey? What kind of actions have you seen there? How does that get operationalized besides talking about his partners?
Well, so Bob Whitman was actually the chief financial officer at Trammell Crow.
Okay.
He learned a lot of the same things that I did there. But Bob is highly inclusive. You know, he has a management meeting every week at which everyone is invited to speak and defend their numbers and their plans. And, you know, it's just feels very collaborative. There's nothing that goes unsaid, and people adjust and admit their mistakes along the way. It's actually quite inspiring. You feel very much at home.
Yeah. You know, I'm interested, obviously, you know, being a Stanford professor for so long and all these accomplishments, my guess is that a lot of people want to talk to you and they have an agenda of what they're looking for from you, or they interview you and they have the agenda of what they want you to say and they're trying to steer a conversation that way or something. What question do you feel like people don't ask you enough, or what's a soapbox for you that you feel like got more airtime?
That's a great question. And I've never thought about it. I just try to respond. My mantra is, you know, what does somebody else looking for? What are they seeking, and how can I help them get there? In many cases, I've found that I'm not the right person. I'm not the answer to what it is they're looking for, but I know a lot of people. And so I redirect. I see myself as kind of a traffic cop, sending people to the right resource. But I don't worry about, you know, what should they be asking me? I mean, I think I know a fair amount about sort of organizational dynamics, how people work, how important the relationships between human beings are. Business is a team sport, and you've got to build a great locker room. You have to really get the right temperature in the room for people to feel like they can really work at high performance levels with each other. They can be complementary. And so I think I know a lot about that and know a lot about building that. I coach a lot of CEOs. So when people ask about that, I end up doing things like writing the 10 Laws of Trust. I'm working on another book now about how to become an entrepreneurial leader. And those are the things that I really feel like I'm most capable of adding value to, but I don't feel like I should be defining what it is people want to know. They want to know whatever they want to know. That's fine. Yeah,
that's great. So I guess my next question would be, you know, I was a really young CEO. I was 28 when I started my little private equity fund in Calgary, right? And had a lot to learn. And here I am, 39, about to start my next one. We're about to do what will likely turn into a real estate investment trust. And there's so many fund managers out there. And yet I look at kind of the, you know, what a reputation and what success Peterson Partners has achieved. What kind of advice would you have somebody in my role who would want to not just be one of the pack, but eventually be much more of a standout and not just do good, but want to really take it to the next level as a fund manager?
So I think you have to understand that you've got more than one constituent. One constituent that most fund managers try to serve are their investors. And they feel like, you know, if I can produce returns for investors that meet or exceed sort of market averages, then I'll raise more capital and I'll be successful and I'll raise more and more money and future funds and whatever. I think that's only one piece of the equation. And I think if you get too fixated on that, you forget that really part of your job is to help those who are running the businesses in which you're investing to be successful, to win on their terms. So I think you want these companies to really do well. You want to coach them. You want to add value. So I think that's the second part of it. And then the third part, I think, is making sure that people who are involved with you, your own employees, your own partners, have rich and happy lives, that where they're working is fun for them, it's meaningful for them, they're achieving their objectives. And I think if you think about all three of those things and balance all three of them, the odds are you'll have a second, third, fourth, and fifth fund. Mm-hmm. We're on, I think, our 11th private equity fund, our third venture fund, our third real estate fund, and success breeds success. But I think you have to deliver on promises. So I would say under promise and over deliver is a great mantra.
Sure. And maybe a follow-up to that, thinking specific where we're kind of looking at doing an open-ended fund and likely, you know, listing it eventually and just kind of doing the buy and hold for the long term, not necessarily raising more funds per se. Just given such extensive real estate background, I think there's such a temptation to think we understand real estate so well, or real estate's maybe easier than life sciences or something, or, you know, maybe we get an ego or something like that. But when you think about the real estate professionals in the investment world that have really got to that next level, is there anything that you think maybe was that difference that they stood apart specifically in that sector?
Yeah, I think the ones that I admire most have a long view. They realize that real estate is cyclical, that there will be ups and downs, and they're not going to lose their way in the ups and the downs. They will sell at certain points in the market. They'll buy at other points in the market. they will create value over time. And then I think they typically have a thesis. You know, they're not just, you know, a lot of people are just opportunists. And I think you can do okay that way, but opportunities come and go and dry up, and, you know, you can get lost. One of my favorite people in the real estate world is a fellow by the name of Hamid Mogadam. Hamid is the chairman and CEO of a company called Prologis, which is a $50 billion REIT. And he really has a thesis, and he's thought it through, and he's very disciplined about it, and they built a great organization. And whenever I see Hamid, I always tell him he's become what I wanted to be when I grew up. He's quite a bit younger than I am and a lot smarter.
So thinking about that one, what's the test? How would a fund manager know I really have a thesis I'm committed to versus, hey, this sounds like a good marketing statement I've told myself as a thesis?
Yeah, I think the idea that this sounds like a good marketing statement is a loser to begin with. You know, something that just sounds good, but doesn't, because ultimately it's a question of supply and demand and a real white space in the market and the ability to deliver on something that isn't easily replicable by competitors. You have to add value. And I think consistently adding value in the market, buying right, selling right, creating value along the way, really takes thought. And you have to see around corners. You have to anticipate the future. You have to take into account everything. You have to, as we were talking about all these constituents that you've got, you have to think about all of the constituents and balance that. And then I think execution. And so I don't think there's one button you push, yeah, say this is the winning button. I think you have to be able to juggle a bunch of balls and keep them all in the air at all times.
That's interesting. Well, maybe kind of for the last little bit here, unless you want to go a different direction, I'm open to that. But I'd be interested, you know, these 10 laws of trust, if there's a Stanford story that sticks out of either, you know, another professor or somebody at the think tank or something that, you know, an individual that in your Stanford life you feel like has really maybe excelled at creating trust, as you've observed.
So I think teachers have a disadvantage in that, or have an advantage, an unfair advantage, I should say, in that they're teaching idealistic young people who are spending a key time and a lot of money and energy to sit at your feet and learn. And so I see people, teachers, responding to that. They care a lot about it. So I see a lot of self-effacing, wonderful professors who really care about these students and their futures. But I think that attracts those kinds of folks. So I see it every day in and out of class.
Yeah. Can you give us a couple of names that come to mind maybe?
Well, I don't want to, you know, I don't want
to leave people out.
Yeah. The problem is, you know, anytime you do that, you leave out somebody who's just the best example of all. I will mention one person who I think is probably, he's kind of the Mr. Chips, if you know that movie. Way back in the day, Mr. Chips was a teacher, I think, at Oxford or somewhere, and was much celebrated by students. There's a fellow here by the name of Irv Grosbeck. And Irv is actually the owner of the Boston Celtics. He's a very successful businessman, but I think he's taught here for maybe 35 years. And before that, he was at Harvard for 8 or 10 years. So he's a longtime teacher. But he's probably inspired as many young entrepreneurs as anybody on the planet. And a lot of it isn't through anything but just taking time for them. They come and they go over a business plan with him. He listens. He asks questions. He pushes back. He encourages. He refines. And then sometimes he'll invest capital. Sometimes he'll serve on their board. Sometimes he'll just send them in the right direction. But to me, he's kind of the archetype of really what a great teacher and example he is.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up the issue of time. I'm a big fan of the David Maister book, The Trusted Advisor, from 20 years ago. And he talks in that one about how so often we don't say when we first met someone, I trust them. You know, that we might say something like, I could see how I could get to trust them, or things like that. But that, you know, as much as we as an individual might consider ourselves trustworthy, that's usually a conclusion that takes multiple points of data points along the way for someone else to come to that conclusion, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, we collect data slowly, and I think it's wisely. Normally what you do is you trust people in small things, and as they deliver on those, you trust them on greater things, and people build up a trust level. I think it's foolish to just turn everything over to somebody that you don't know. In the beginning of the book, I talk about the three factors that you have to look at in order to trust somebody, and they are character, competence, and authority. And if people don't have all three of those, it's folly to trust them. So I think trust is one of these things that people misunderstand. They think it is, oh, I trusted him. I really and what they really mean by that is, I liked this person. I had this good, warm, fuzzy feeling. They said great things. Well, that's kind of the recipe for con men. There's con artists who are out there who know how to make you feel like you should trust them. In fact, they're confidence men. That's really what it comes from, is they give you confidence. They make you want to trust them. Well, really, you have to say, do they have high character? Are they competent? Do they have the skills to deliver on promises? And then, are they authorized? Do they have the authority? Do they have the way, the means, the organization, the whatever it takes to deliver on a promise? And typically, that takes some time.
Yeah, maybe this one will be my real final question, but on the competence one, you know, I see that as so important, where, you know, somebody who's nice but doesn't have the background is probably not the ideal person to trust, you know, for advice on something. And yet,
not ideal.
Yeah, and yet it can feel like there could be a temptation to slip into kind of the ego or the lack of humility to focus on me and my skills and my accomplishments. But it seems like there's a balance beam there of, if we don't put in the hard work and we don't maybe go the extra mile beyond the average, then, you know, what competence are we actually bringing to the table? Can you talk about that balance beam as you see it, of the doing our part to bring the highest level of competence without it becoming about us or our ego or our accolades?
Well, ego, accolades, you know, self-possession, self-importance or whatever, do not bring competence. In fact, they often get in the way of competence. Competence is the skills, the training, the education, the experience to deliver on promises. So I do this exercise with a lot of my students, where I say, you know, who do you trust most in the world? And the person most people will identify as their mothers. And why? Well, because your mom has your back. She cares about you. Her love is unconditional. And that's a character matter. But then I ask them, would you trust her to fly a 747 to London? And most people realize, oh my gosh, that'd be a disaster. You can't trust her to do that because she's never been in the left seat of a jumbo jet. So she doesn't have that particular competence. So I think you have to line people up with their character, their competence, and their authority to actually trust them. And if your ego is somehow part of that equation, you're missing out. This is stupid trust.
Yeah.
It's a trust that will fail you.
That's great. Well, to close here, one of my favorite questions, I'll give you the choice. You can choose either one of these that you like. Either, what's a piece of advice you would like to go back and give a younger version of yourself if you had the chance? Or what's one of the best pieces of advice you feel like you ever received?
So the best advice, well, I received two great pieces of advice from two great mentors. One was Peter Drucker, who told me one time, we used to go out and see him out at Claremont when I was young. And he said, make your weaknesses irrelevant and build on your strengths. In other words, don't spend your time trying to fix the things that aren't strong about you. Figure out where you're really great and then build on those. Make that your offering. And the second one came from Bob Waterman, who wrote In Search of Excellence with Tom Peters back in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. Waterman was my coach when I was first CEO at Trammell Crow. He attended a board meeting and just watched what I did. And I thought I'd done a great job, and so I expected him to say that. And the only thing he said to me was, "You talk too much." wasn't that really pretty good? And he just said, "You talk too much." And that was great advice. And I think it started me on this quest to listen more actively, to capture what other people are saying. And I got better by working at it. So those were two pieces of advice that have impacted me.
I love it. Well, thanks for making so much time for us here today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great to talk, Jess.
Yeah. Well, so everybody, please go to joelcpeterson.com, and that's Peterson, S-O-N, or look up the 10 Laws of Trust on Amazon, or, you know, Joel's got half a million followers on LinkedIn, you know, get his advice there. And thanks everybody for listening. Bye. Well, that's it for the episode. One other thing I wanted to tell you about, if you'll remember the guys from Convoy in episodes back, Ken Free and Trent Mano, I went on one of their CEO trips to New York and I met a guy named Brent Thompson, very successful entrepreneur. He was former CEO of Jive Communications, big company now, I think $300 or $400 million. Anyways, he started a new company called blipbillboards.com. I'm super stoked they're a sponsor now. But I remember a year and some ago when I met him, I thought it was genius. Instead of having to buy 6 months or a year's worth of billboard for thousands of dollars, you can buy 8 seconds at a time for like 10 or 20 cents. You pick what billboard you want it on, what time of day you want it to run. And it just puts so much power in the hands of marketers and CEOs who want to try something and see if it works. You can buy as many or as few as you want, change it as many times as you want. I think now our podcast is being advertised on billboards in like 18 different states because we have these guys as sponsors. We're pretty excited about it. Hope you check out blipbillboards.com. Thanks.